I need someone's gonna have to volunteer to go through. We already have the help with the numerical part on 210 from Ryan, right, hopefully, a couple weeks ago. But that wasn't it. There's more to the problem set than that. And so we should try to go through the rest.
210. Yeah, 211. So this is the degeneracy pressure business. So which of you wants to go through it?
Is it a bit long?
Well, we have an hour.
I can do like part A and B and then somebody else does.
Sure, that's fine. Yeah. You just volunteered. Great, that's fine. So this is 2.11, right? I mean, that's what you're talking about.
I wasn't sure about what C and D, so it's a bit.
Okay, so in part A, we want to calculate what are the total energy for the fermions in a degenerate gas. So in a degenerate gas, fermions, they fill up the levels or layers from the innermost layer on up to the Fermi level. So if you want to see what is the total number of the fermions in all those layers, we can integrate over the if you want to see what is the number of fermions in like momentum space, we have to integrate over the total space of the momentum, something like that.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Okay. It was a little tricky, but.
Yeah. No. It's a new way of thinking about counting.
Okay. I wasn't sure about 2 pi h bar. Is that the space that each of the fermion occupies in momentum space? Okay.
You know why, too, right? I mean, you remember the uncertainty?
Uncertainty principle, yes. Yes. It's almost h.
Right, so there's a b there, right? And so what you really did was you integrated over d3x, d3p, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So to normalize that, you just have to test the volume per.
Yep. Okay. So that's the total number, and if we assume that energy per fermion in non-relativistic case is just pi squared over 2 times mass. So the total energy in non-relativistic case is E times N, which is going to be the substitute for N. Well, I had the problem that Maple wasn't simplifying for me these solutions. So that's why I had to make a note for myself.
That's fine. You can just do that by hand.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, I could actually, but I was lazy. Anyways, so.
New kids today. With computers going
So that's the first part, I guess. Just want to see what is the total energy.
Can you briefly interpret for us what's different between those two?
Oh, what's the difference? Well, in relativistic case, we have like a C factor, which we don't have in the non-relativistic case. So I guess.
There's more factors.
And H bar.
And.
I guess it should be the same.
That's the critical difference. The energy decreases faster.
Energy decreases faster in.
Increases faster for in the non-relativistic. So that's where the. That's the critical difference.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Grant.
Okay. And in this. And we want to see what is the. We want to find a limit for the density in. Non-relativistic case or something like that. So. For that. Well, we assume that if we consider what is the Coulomb force between electrons and positive nuclei in a Fermi gas, it just Z E squared over A, where A is mean distance. And
can you explain
this one? The mean distance? I wasn't sure, actually.
Okay, so we'll think about it. The first formula you're going to find out, right?
Yeah.
What is it? Z is?
Z is just the total number of the nuclei.
Yeah,
electrons.
So if you draw a nucleus and an electron.
Okay. So that's the nucleus, and
probably just try to think of the electron. At the moment, just think of the electron as a point particle going by.
Okay.
So the point though there is right there. So the charge of the nucleus is.
So that's A probably.
That's right.
Okay.
And the charge of the nucleus is.
It's just Z E.
So the charge of the electron is. Exactly. How would you estimate, like, if you have so what is n over b or b over n? Can you interpret that?
Well, n over v is the same as rho over n. M over rho.
Right, but rho over n has another name.
Yeah, mn.
Just get the number.
Yeah.
So you can see why the number. So the number density is what you mean.
It's just density per volume, or unit volume.
Number per volume, right? But number doesn't protect units.
No.
So that's the unit carrier, right? So you get a length from 1/n. Mm-hmm. So then the question is just how come you put z rather than just being 1/n, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for that, for a nucleus of number density n, but how many electrons would have carried into the plasma if it started out neutral?
I don't understand.
So that nucleus,
okay.
if it were out in the real world in neutral, how many electrons would it carry?
As much as it fills up, I guess. That...
So, is that right?
Yeah.
So the number density of electrons versus the number density of nuclei is what? How many more? Write the equation for the number of electrons.
Oh, just volume, and then volume to the power of 1/3 is just distance. So.
Exactly. Right. So, but do you see where it comes from now?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay.
Did everybody else see where that comes from? It's an important point. A lot of the times the physics is in these like little assumptions.
And now we want to see, what is the limit that we can treat electrons, as like ideal gas in this, Fermi gas. So if you want to have that condition, then kinetic energy per electron, which is E over N, it should be smaller than Coulomb energy. So that shouldn't be significant Coulomb energy in that case. After Maple didn't simplify it for me, and I did it by hand, I get this limit, which is what is in the book. And for section B, we want to carry on to pressures. Let's see what are the pressures in non-relativistic and what? Yes, sir.
The interpretation is the part I keep on suggesting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and if we want to have like an ideal case, ideal gas, then we should go to higher and higher densities, which makes sense.
Right. So what would spoil that? What changes on the right hand side?
Mm-hmm.
And like we're not on the right hand side, but so I guess you can't really adjust any of those numbers. It's just
mm-hmm.
So is this harder to achieve for if the average atomic number is larger, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So for a smaller nuclei, I guess we have a better estimate or something like that.
Right. And can you explain why that's true? What's the
well, because Coulomb energy then won't be very significant. So I guess, yeah. Okay.
I know. It's true. That's
okay.
It's for posterity. People will be watching these lectures for years.
Yeah.
Not to make any nervous.
Okay. So pressure in non-relativistic case is 2/3 of ENR over V. And where does that come from? Comes from the fact that if you assume for ideal gas, the ideal gas law, EV is NKT and energy per electrons. Have KT, then it is compare P over V. So for this case, then we get and for the relativistic case, it's just 1/3 E over V. So I guess in this case, the ideal gas, the energy per electron will be like 3 kT instead of 3.5. So that's why we get that.
We should pause at this point. These pressure to, remember, we derived these before, these pressure to radius, pressure to density relations, known as whatever pressure equations. So did NEA actually ever tell you what it's called whenever it's a pressure is related to the density to the power?
Polytropic.
Have we discussed this at all?
No, not
okay.
Class.
Yeah, so it's a key point that I forgot to mention before, but you should know. This is called a polytrope. P, you can write it out. Maybe you have it, maybe you all already know this, but this is very important throughout all of astrophysics. So just to know that whenever someone says this is polytropic, it means that this is the equation of state has this form. Stars are basically polytropes. Many things are polytropic, and there are chapters of books written about studying polytropic equations of state. There's even kind of discussion of polytropic equations of state in a paper that I wrote. If you ever wanted to look it up, so it's just worth emphasizing for a moment that anytime you end up with a polytropic equation of state, make contact with a huge literature, and much is known about. And anyway, I wanted to be sure that was mentioned. But, okay, carry on, sorry. I'm going to interrupt again.
So it's a second derivation of these two formulas.
What?
It's the second derivation of them.
This is?
Yeah. We derived them in the previous problem.
Yep.
So it didn't ask for deriving them again.
Did it?
No.
I think you could
use just those two formulas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you could have just.
Okay. So from the
relationship. Yeah. If you didn't derive any problems. I'm glad you did that because I wanted to.
Okay.
Read my mind.
More work. So we assume that M is the same as MPA over Z here.
Everybody knows what A is.
A just mass number? Okay.
Just the mass number for the I get a little of this is. Padmanabhan is a little annoying in his sort of thing.
Yeah.
So if ever you find yourself puzzling over something, don't feel bad. It's just you may not have ever defined it. Just assuming that you happen to know this. You can usually figure it out if you think. Like in this case, you have to. It has to be that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just for time. And he's just making this up. And he's making another implicit assumption here, which is a very good one, though. Can anyone tell me what it is? writing out the mass for a
ignoring the mass of the electron.
What? Well, he's certainly ignoring the mass of the electron. That's yeah, he's but and but that has ignoring the mass of the electron has another consequence for nuclear. Well, nuclei are made up of protons and
neutrons.
Do neutrons and protons have the same?
No.
Exactly. But you're assuming here that they do.
Yes. But the difference of them is all the order of an electron mass.
Bingo. So you've made that assumption. Is it just to remind yourself, you're making assumptions all over the place. But it's okay. That didn't
happen. Okay. So for the next part that we want to prove those equations, either hydrostatic equations or for that, well, if we assume, you know, we have to consider what is the pressure force here. The pressure force for an element of, you know, an element of matter in a star will be. And in hydrostatic equilibrium, pressure and gravity they are balanced out. So we can, you know, equate this with the with gravity and see how they relate. So if G is the same as G and R and for that element. R squared. I'm assuming Vn is Vr A. That's right. So if we equate Fg and Fp, and what we get is and gmr over r squared is just d phi over dr.
You could have just used the average first equation and written it down right away. Right, because the equation for Euler's equation. This is a nice one.
And and the Gauss equation in a spherical symmetry will be fine over dr. So if you substitute in there, then we get
P equals P proportional to just write out a general equation for a polytropic equation of state.
example, for number.
Yeah, just to maybe to make it more general, assume 5/3 could be any.
And please, it's a gamma.
Yeah, just like yeah, just take away the NRs and make that a gamma.
Like that.
Okay. And then take away the NRs just to make it like anything. And then if you could write down what that solution looks like, you have the basic equation of stellar force balance.
Okay, so you mean I differentiate this relative.
Yes, yeah, so it's a special case of what it's just a generalized version of what you have.
Okay. Well, dp over dr, you mean, or okay. U over dr. So dp over 0 is just gamma rho to power s. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have seen this before.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you see that if you insert, well, if you just like, if you wanted to write an argument that. That right there is like really important way. Does everyone see how that will govern a spherically symmetric self-gravitating body with any equation of state at this point? And particularly, you derive it in this case. Lots of times, it's better, even though you have, it's good to go through and put in the numbers and the particular equations. Lots of times, it's important just to see how the structure of these equations, because then you can apply it to a lot of different cases. Mm-hmm. Is that it?
Well, for part A and B.
Right. That leaves only one person left. There's not two people who can do part A. Who wants to do it? Which of you wants to do it?
Yeah, I read the solution. It seems very, I don't understand it very well. And I need, or I think it has to be solved numerically, this CND.
Well, that was part of the assignment, but you don't actually have to use, I mean, you can just use the numbers in the text. Anybody want to take a stab at it? Brian, do you want to do it? Yeah, do you have it in your assignment?
I think so. I can give it a shot. It's been a while, so it's
okay. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, if you don't want
to. Yeah, I'll try.
CND doesn't really make sense to me.
Okay. Well, just quickly,
understanding
that. So it'll be good to discuss because the tricks that you are taken through in parts C and D are very important to practical solutions. Sorry, do you want to?
Okay. first thing C asks us to do is show from dimensional considerations that the solution to the non-relativistic case must have the form rho of R is proportional to big R to the negative 6 times some function R over R, and right. Just from dimensional considerations.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, working with dimensional analysis, let's write out all the values we have, their dimensions, as always. Likewise, you can one
I noticed the recognizable handwriting on the wall. Sorry, Ron. You'll be a pro at this before you
run.
When I was whenever I had one of my major oral exams in my PhD, the entire hour and a half exam was involved with me doing being asked to do dimensional analysis problem in front of three professors. So you never know when you're going to have to be called on to do this on the fly. So you'll be ready.
Okay. This one is more complicated than most dimensional problems I've shown, but I'll just skip the solution. Basically, we just want to, I'll show you the solution, and we can check that it works. Okay. And so, in fact, here we've got two-dimensional quantities. We've got, obviously, the ratio, R over R, and yep. Okay. We also in theory, we could also use little r in here, but
typically speaking, if you're going to want to use only one thing. You usually just pick one.
Yeah, we just pick big R, and then. In theory, we could morph it around adding little r with that constant playing in, but yeah, okay. And let's just go over the dimensions to show that this works. First of all, working with length, okay, 12, L on top, subtract 9, we're at 3. Let's see, add 3, we're at 6, subtract 6, we're at 0, okay. Mass, okay, we're at minus 2 on top. At 3, we're at 1, subtract 1, we're at 0. And time, yeah, we're at negative 6 on top, add 6 on the bottom, so yeah, works out.
Yeah, so there is another, in this one, there is another way to approach it, which is the way that the book suggests. Maybe I can just.
Yeah, sure.
But you're absolutely right, of course. This is an alternative way to approach the problem, but just to make sure that I realize that there's other ways to do these. So the point is that thank you, Mark. And I may call you back if you're right.
Okay.
Yeah, I figured.
About this, we need two quantities without dimension, and we just find
so
find two.
Yeah,
I can explain it later once you show. Say
yeah. So that point. Yeah. So you can just make these combinations in some way that eliminates dimension, and you usually end up that gives you usually.
Okay, but I don't understand the relation with density. How we can see that this is. Multiplicate these two with two best density.
Okay, maybe I'll just go through and show how this comes out into another function, and we can get to the other method, if that's all right. Yeah, OK. Anyways, dimensional analysis, when we only have one quantity, is simple. Okay, when we only have one quantity, it's simple. We set that dimensionless quantity equal to a constant. When we have two quantities, we set some function of the two of them equal to a constant. Which, okay, so in this case, we say let's just call this d1 and d2. So we've got f of d1. And d2 equals some constant k. So then let's just fiddle things around a bit. Assume the function is invertible, which is usually the case. So we can take let's say, well, invertible relative to some variable. What we can do is change it to using different functions. F1 of d1 equals f2 of d2. And which basically shows that you can split up the quantities in some manner. And in theory, if you want, you can morph around the functions. Then what we do is we take the inverse of one of them. In this case, we're going to want to leave in the function of little r of big R. So then we get d2, which is this, equals some function R over R. Okay, so let's replace D2 with what we have there. Okay. I'll just say F and save space. First thing we do is we flip the left side one over it, and we'll just have another function, which is the inverse, or one over the left, not inverse. So and finally, let's move everything but throw to this side, to the right side, and then we'll absorb G and lambda and R are just constants, so we can absorb them into the function, finally getting rho naught equals R to the negative 6. F of little r big R. Does that all make sense?
We know R is constant.
You just chose an R to be some scale. So that's very good.
You're trying to get a two-dimensional quantities, and one of them has the quantity that you want to analyze with the
This is a general thing that you can always do whenever it is. But looking at a system for problem can be a happy thing. A little bit, something maybe a slightly different. For this particular case, there is a slightly simpler way, not simpler, but maybe more algorithmic way of doing it. Because looking at this one, you may think that, how am I ever supposed to just come up with these numbers, and how am I supposed to know it's the right thing for a chemical? But as Brian was saying, that's not quite right. But for here, it's not too crazy. So I'm just going to, leave out some of these comments and just say that. Go ahead and write it. So for the non-relative, for this is a non-relativistic case. This is the book asks. So you can do it equally well. So this is the equation. Okay. And so the trick, so the way to look at this is that you only have, you have two variables left. So like Brian said, this basically, you're going to have two dimensionless quantities. This is variable r, and this variable rho, okay? And so to make any differential equation or integral dimensionless, what you do is you just say, well, rho, I know, is going to have dimensions, mass over length cubed, right? And so what I can do is just say that rho is a function of r, going to be given by some dimension carrying constant, some value like 10 grams per cubic centimeter or something, times just, some function that just depends on r. Okay. But this is where this function is dimensionless. And so to keep this function dimensionless, I know that I'm not going to be able to work with r, and I'm going to pull out r. Again, a dimension-carrying constant that does not change times some dimension-free number that scales, that gives you the scale here. So if we all agree, so this is basically, this is your units, and this is your number, right? So if you say this room is 8 meters long. So this is 8, and this is meters. Okay, so we all do this naturally. We know that we have some number that represents our the magnitude of the length, and then some unit that tells us how to interpret that. And so all you're doing is doing that explicitly.
Well, I'm guaranteeing the D2 function.
You just assert it because this is dimensions of density, mm-hmm. And so then the dimensions and the density. So what you're really going to do is put x in here, keep it dimensionless. And so then the density always has units of density, and so you can always measure it. Whatever that function is, you can always, if you have the density looks like this, whatever, it's some function. It's always at every one of these points, the density is going to be like 8, 3, 10, right? It's going to be units of something. So the overall scaling here is irrelevant. You can rescale that freely, and the shape changes.
My question is, the arm is not dimensionless.
Yeah, right. So
how do you guarantee the intruder of R?
Okay. Right. So that's a very good question. So the point is, we don't know what this function is yet. So before we write it down, we're free to rewrite it in any way we like and just decide what we're going to look for, right? And so what you do is you say, okay, I want a dimension-free equation, a function times some dimension-full constant. So then we're going to rewrite our equation, and then we're going to solve our equation for this. We don't know what any of this is. We're just playing around. But the point is that once we know we're going to solve for this, then we get something that doesn't have any dimensions in it. Turns out that that's always what you're going to do. That's always a good idea to do when you're going to do a numerical problem. Because computers like numbers of order one. And by going to dimension, if you go to a good choice of dimensionless functions, then you often can keep from doing crazy numbers. Like, if you try to measure table mass in terms of electron masses, and then try to put in numbers, you have all these huge exponents, right? And it's impossible to get anything. It just tend to be 87 stuff. Like, I mean, it's great. I mean, obviously, that's not the critical things. Like, the table mass is one half as much as, you know, the chair, or twice as much as the chair, right? That's that ratio that you really care about. So the absolute number, if you want to vary into a constant, but you're going to care for it. Okay, anyway, so this is the program here. So you take the two things that are actually variable, the independent variable and the dependent function, right? And pull out their units. So when you do that, then you can just take this equation, this differential equation, and just rewrite it. So it's just Rx squared, E over D, Rx. Rx. Over so not to the one third, g to the one third, d rho not to the one third, but rho not g, d r x. And then because all of these, so because we've chosen these to be constants, right, they can just be pulled out. So we end up with just among our constants, we have 1 over r squared, 1 over r. R squared. What?
This is an easy way.
Yeah. So this is for whenever you have.
Because we already have a relation for p from rho and r.
Yeah, exactly. So even though this is important. So what Ryan did is actually more general. This lets you analyze problems you already know the equations, which is why it's very good to know. But if you already have an equation, this is a much more straightforward way of doing it. So anyway, you pull all this out, and then you get to the differential equation, just like whatever. X squared over g over one third g.
But that doesn't have any units.
Right, so there's no units left here. All of the units are here.
It's your f of r.
And so the key thing that for this, what they're asking here is that. On the right hand side, there's only one of these, which is just rho. So, so just to simplify this, r squareds go out. So this is really rho naught to the 4/3 over r, right?
Isn't it 2/3? And r squared in the bottom.
Sorry, what?
I wasn't.
No, that was completely wrong. Okay. Anyway, so but we have basically some dimensionless function. And then root naught to the 2/3 over r squared. And that's going to be equal to 5 lambda constant times rho 0, right? And so again, no dimension differential equation equals this, and then r squared rho naught to the 1/3, right? And so this is the origin. This is another way to get to the origin of the rho naught being proportional to 1 over r. So yeah, basically. Since this is all going to have to end up being dimensionless, the relative ratio of rho to r. Rho is proportional to r. Does that make sense? It's just because r is where the one variable is. So that's
don't G and lambda have dimension?
G and yes, they do. But And you can, so if you wanted to, you can work that out. But I mean, the critical thing is our because you know that you know what has to work out. This
yeah, I know what those, but I'm just thinking they have dimensions. So like, where are those dimensions? Like G and lambda both have dimensions. Mm-hmm. So like, we're equating the two sides. I mean, I know it has to work.
No, it's just talking about in the answer. These particular variables are like, these obviously cancel dimensionlessly. But we know that the G of the lambda here is going to balance dimensions, whatever the left dimension. So this is just the dependence. And if you change the length scale, the density is going to change in this place. Because lambda and G are both things that are just prefixed. You can't change.
Yeah.
You can't change lambda, which is just a bunch of fundamental constants.
They're going to work.
And so, so all you can change are the length scale, the relevant length scale, and the relevant density scale.
I think lambda actually does have a small dependence on which element.
Sure.
That's about it.
So. Does that make sense? So these are the two that you introduce.
Now we're out of time.
So that's good. And so this being able to do this is something that definitely need to do again in your lives. I found this when I was first had to do this, which my very first research project, I found this doing this at all and how completely mystifying for some reason, but it isn't actually as bad. All right, so you have your new assignment. So I gave you, I think everybody got it. You have reading. So
is this related to the assignment?
Yes. So assignment for 3.10, mm-hmm. It just comes off of what we've already know. It's the last fluid mechanics problem. A couple of people mm-hmm. suggested that they would like to study shockwaves. And so mm-hmm. the shockwave problem. It's pretty cool. Shockwaves are pretty, it turns out, all you need is the conservation of like mass and it's like the fluid. Whenever you mention like the fluid equations, really all it means is like conservation of mass and momentum and energy. That's it. It's very simple. It turns out you can learn a heck of a lot just by assuming like shocks or discontinuities where mass, energy, and momentum are conserved.
Well, all physics is.
Yeah, you can say that, right? And most of the physics isn't necessarily just continuous. But then for 4.10, optimization, which is a very important process, you really need the results of 3.10 in Pantanabon. So, but since this is important, and because I didn't want you necessarily have to work out a lot, 3.9 to 3.10. I also gave you this chapter from. It's very nice. This whole book is ridiculously overpriced. So it's called Radiative Processes in Astrophysics by George Ryberkin and Alan Lightman. Anyway, it's a good book for anything having to do with radiation. Anyway, so I pulled out the optimization chapter to give you an alternate perspective to Padmanabhan, so that you wouldn't be confused by that. Okay, so we gotta go. All right.